If you think bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred, then we say hallelujah. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. The Non Sequitur podcast is produced by Boolinonator, and is recorded from the live stream on YouTube, Monday through Friday, at 8 PM Eastern, unless otherwise indicated. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. That's NONSEQ show.com. To get the latest news, polls and random photos throughout the day, follow us on Twitter, at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. If you'd like to get exclusive content, buy weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, early podcast releases and much more, consider becoming a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur for more information. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
To go live like we are right now to say something that's going to make me laugh and screw up my whole introduction that I had. Leave it to KC. Hello, everybody.
You're welcome.
Welcome to Non Sequitur. I'm Kyle Curtis. I'm joined tonight by a full house of lovely people. We've got Steve McRae, as always. Dave and Dave, actually. Tonight, we're in the back producing. We've got everybody's audio level sounding perfect. KC. Look at you.
Hi. Here. I'm here. How are you? I'm good. I left work early just for you.
You're so great. Well, we're glad you're here. And we also have two very special guests with us this evening. You probably recognize both of them, actually, especially Mr. Sargon of Akkad, who is with us. Welcome, sir. Thank you for coming on.
No, thank you for the invite.
Absolutely. And we'll introduce you both properly here in just a second. I'm just saying initial hellos. Brittany, how are you doing? You made probably the best entrance that I've ever seen anybody on this show before. Her camera came up in the screen and she was in pose, just like just like you see on your screen. So she made quite the interest. Welcome, Brittany. It's very nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you guys. I'm stoked. Thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to get to the discussion here in just a second. KC is going to lead that all for us. As we always do, we're going to go through what we got coming up. Just real quickly, I'm going to keep it brief tonight. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock, that's 8 Eastern, Tim O'Neill will be joining us. He runs a blog that seeks to correct the use of biases, erroneous information, and distorted pseudo-history that anti-theist atheists sometimes use in their arguments. It ranges from medieval flat earth to the myth of Jesus existing and even the church and the Nazis. You hear that a lot sometimes too in apologetics and on the atheist side. So he runs a blog. It's thehistoryforatheist.com. He will be with us tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern. Then on Saturday, we did this twice before. It worked out really good. So we're going to try to do the full thing this Saturday. And that is debate roulette. If you don't know what that is, what we do, you join our Discord server. And there's a special section for you to go to if you want to participate. Now, we will spin a wheel on the screen. And wherever it lands, that will be the topic for that particular round. Everybody votes in the Discord server, and then the system picks two random people, one from each side, and you come on the show, and you debate each other on that topic. It's structured. You get three rounds of back and forth, and then an open dialogue discussion. Both shows that we had last time went phenomenally well. We were expecting a dumpster fire, but we did not get it. So when that does come, it's going to be really big, but hopefully this time it will go just as smoothly. So we're going to try to get three rounds in on that this Saturday. That is also at 8 p.m. Eastern. And then on Sunday, we will be joined by Aaron Ra again. This will be his probably eighth appearance on the show. People have been asking about him, so we've got him back. He will be debating old Earth creationist George Lujack. So join us for that. That also is at 8 o'clock Eastern. And I think that is it, unless we're, let me go to the next slide, David. Did I put Flatline in here? Yep. Okay, so I'm going to just do this very quickly. Flatline is going to be similar to Debate Roulette, but with our Flat Earth friends. We didn't want to leave them out. This is going to be run differently. I'll explain how that is later on in the week, how that's going to work. Just the audience is going to decide if their evidence holds up or not. I kind of have a feeling how that's going to go, but nonetheless, we will give them the shot. So that will be Sunday, June 24th. Okay, I think that's the quickest I've ever been through those. And now I'm going to turn it over to KC, who is going to introduce the topic for this evening and get more in depth.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank both of you guys for coming on the show today. I've had the pleasure of having conversations with both of you, and I think you're both great conversationalists. We don't necessarily agree on all things, and I know you guys individually don't agree with each other on all the things, but I really respect people who can have productive and civil conversations with each other about things that they so starkly contrast about. So today we're going to be talking about social justice and intersectionality. They're two really broad topics. Like Brittany was talking about before the show, we're barely even going to get to scratch the surface of some of this stuff. But let's just kick it off with a little summary of what these things are. So social justice issues are divided into two pretty broad categories: inter-social treatment, so basically how we treat each other, and unequal government regulation, which is how the government applies law to people. So intersocial treatment can be based on a variety of factors: race, gender, age, sexual orientation, economic background, education, all kinds of different things, mental, physical abilities, things like that. Unequal government regulation, that category kind of deals with how the government uses these factors to create conditions that obstruct, limit, or deny groups access to the same opportunities and resources. And that's relative to the rest of society. This type of regulation can lead to intentional and unintentional social injustice. Some examples of these areas are voting laws, education, policing, environmental laws, healthcare regulation, and labor laws, things like that. Intersectionality is another topic that we're probably going to talk about some. This is just a framework that attempts to analyze the interconnected nature of social categories like race, gender, age, sexual orientation, etc., and how they overlap to describe interdependent systems of discrimination and disadvantages in more complex social categories, and how those are impacted through unequal government regulation. So, for example, it seeks to explain how the experiences of a gay, white, non-religious woman from a poor family differs from that of a straight Black Christian man from a middle-class family, and shows how the social and legal systems impact them or is applied to them differently. And that ideally, I mean, the idea of it is that it can better pinpoint our problem areas to help us fix them. So that's pretty much what we're going to be talking about. It's kind of hard to summarize those things down here, but I think it's important in these kind of discussions to get to an agreement on definitions. So I know that Brittany was, you know, really wanting to do that first. So why don't we start off with Brittany and talking about definitions of things, so we make sure we're all on the same page.
Yeah, I would love to. So my name is Brittany Simon. Hi, I'm a full-time content creator online. I mostly help people in their alternative lifestyles. I introduce new kinks and educational things in regards to those kinks. I teach people how to do cuckolding correctly. Carl, call me. And one of the things that I want to do is talk about... I mean, teach the room. No problem.
You know that was a thing.
So it's one of those things where... It's just a little joke. I do watch your stuff, Carl. I'm aware that you mention cucking a lot. And I just want to, you know, as somebody who likes the king.
I don't mention cucking a lot.
He uses it as an insult. Well, you use it as an insult. And so it's like one of those things where I, you know, well, that's what I'm talking about. So it's insults. True. So from my perspective, one of the things that I want to do is to talk about what we have in common, because I actually think we have a lot more in common than we probably don't have in common. So okay. We're both, just so I'm on the same page, right? Because I've never had a chance to talk to you. We're both like free speech absolutists, right? Mm-hmm. Are you an atheist? I don't know this about you.
I am an atheist.
Okay, so we're both atheists. And then you're from the UK. I'm from America. My parents are immigrants from Iraq. I'm not sure about your background in terms of any of that stuff, but I'm not sure if we have anything in common there. But I find that those two beginning factors are a pretty good start, a foundation for a really good conversation. I try very hard to look at the weirder parts of how people come to conclusions about these subjects. So intersectionality in particular is something that's very interesting to me. Kimberly Crenshaw, who came up with it in 1989, is one of my favorite thinkers. I think her ideas and concepts are solid. I think that some of the ways that younger feminists have run with her ideas are not exactly how I think she intended them from my understanding of her philosophy, and also not how I also kind of run with intersectionality. So maybe we can talk about that as a starting point, just because I think there's a lot of miscommunication with what intersectionality is. I've noticed younger people will say, I'm unapologetically intersectional. And that's not quite how that works, right? It's an understanding of systematic oppression and social interaction, but I don't think you can be apologetically a philosophy or a system that's just making comment on a system that exists. That's a weird idea to me. So starting off there, I don't identify as like, if you're not intersectional, you're not feminist. Like, again, those are two philosophies that intertwine, yes, but they can be completely separate from one another. And so for me, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page in that regard from where I'm coming from, because I don't know if you're familiar with my content or not.
I'm not familiar with the content, but I am familiar with your sphere of thought. I suppose I would need a definition from you of what you consider to be oppression.
On a, in a systematic way, in a social way, in an individual way.
Or just however you're defining the word oppression, really.
Okay. If you would like, and if this helps, I can give you a very specific example that might help put it into perspective. My version of oppression, the efficacy of oppression can differ. I don't think oppression is inherently not authentic. Or sorry.
Okay, what's the definition for oppression that you're using?
One person stopping another person from living the life they want in any capacity. I think that's pretty valid.
Okay, because that seems like a really broad definition to me, and I can think of many instances where it's completely valid for someone to stop someone else from living the life they want to live.
Exactly. So people, we agree on this.
Well, no. I mean, that's not the definition of oppression I use. I mean, for example.
Okay.
I mean, for example, the communists definitely don't. Communists are definitely going to make me live a life that I don't want to live, and me stopping them from doing that is me stopping them from living the life they want to live. So,
correct.
I don't consider my resistance to communism to be oppression of communists. So that's why I wanted to start with the definition of oppression that you're using, because I think it's important.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. So you really, I'm going to implore you to really just learn Britney, because if you lump me in with the left and the mainstream people that are often targeted in media, we're not going to be on the same page. So for me, oppression is needed in an efficient society, because even in a free society like America, we have those qualms, like the baker who just recently was granted by the Supreme Court the allowance to reject any art he doesn't want to display. I am on the baker's side as a queer woman, because I believe that his right as an artist trumps someone else's right as a customer. But if he had rejected the couple full on out, then I would say that was discrimination based off of just basic service. But an art form, it makes you different. So that, though there is oppression happening, it is not, it's the fairest, most, it's the fairest form of oppression a free society, I think, can have, is coming to that compromise, which is, here is okay. The line. I think private businesses, go ahead.
So yeah, just because, I mean, you're presupposing oppression there, and I don't agree that any oppression is taking place there, which is why I wanted you to define oppression, because then I know how you personally envisage it.
So I guess oppression for me, there's two forms. There's the legal status, which is important. Is someone bigger mm-hmm. and on the books denying you rights and an ability to live the life you want? And then why are they doing that? The why is the key to all my philosophy in life. Why are they doing it? Is there a legit, logical, and efficient reason they are denying you the right to do something? And I think in a lot of cases we do, right? We wear seatbelts. We don't fuck children. We shouldn't, at least, even though there's 250,000 child brides in the United States, through legal loopholes. So that kind of stuff makes a difference. Socially, I think there's oppression through classism, obviously. And I think that plays a huge role. And then racism is something that has trickled down from our past. So that's pretty, you know, that's there. I don't think these things are without, I don't think you can have a society without these things. What I think the left is asking for, what I think they should be asking for at least, is not, you know, equal opportunity, not equal outcome, because that's ridiculous. But what we're asking for is opportunity in a legal and representative sense. We're asking for an acknowledgement that the past was hard and difficult and rooted in racism and systematic oppression. And what we're asking is, hey, we need to change the system. Because listen, Carl, if we believe in individuals and these individuals say, hey, the system's not quite working for me, then we should say, oh, you should change the system to work for you. What did you have in mind? And then if they give us ideas that maybe don't quite work efficiently, we should be able to counter with logic and fact to say, okay, well, here's a better solution, but I really acknowledge you as an individual and I'm sorry you're struggling. Maybe this is a good compromise. I don't belittle people. I don't use certain language. I make sure that I understand, as an atheist, especially living in a society that is primarily religious people, I'm dealing with non-truth constantly. So my issue is that we are dealing with objective truth, subjective truth, and we don't live in a world where the two aren't one. So at least not in America. Okay. I can't speak for anyone else.
Okay, but I can't get past the definition. Yeah, at the moment, I can't get past the definition of oppression because the way you've just defined it is someone. I'm sorry?
Could you share yours so I'm on the same page?
Well, yeah, I will do, but I just want to talk about yours a bit more just because I find what you're laying out very interesting, because you saying someone preventing you from living the life you want to live. I mean, if the life I want to live is owning a yacht and sailing around the world, then the person who has the yacht that I can't afford to buy is preventing me from living the life I want to live. Therefore, by that definition, they would be oppressing me. But I don't think that by anyone else's definition, that would be considered oppression. So I think that the definition you're using is remarkably broad. I mean, the standard English definition of oppression is cruel or unjust treatment over a prolonged period of time. And I think by that definition, very few things in Western society are actually oppression. And I think that's what, I mean, that's the world I perceive. And I think it's the world that most people out of intersectionality outside of that, that's how they perceive it as well.
That is interesting. And that's definitely a food for thought. I would love to explore that more. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to hijack the whole live show just talking about that. But that is so interesting to me. And I think that's where the disconnect lies. If we can't even define oppression, then how will we move forward? So usually what I like to do is I am an individual absolutist, which means I want to hear every single individual case. If individuals exist, if I want to represent them in my county or city or whatever, then I don't care what category you fall into. What I care about is, what is your story? How do you function within society? How do you want to function in society? And how does society have to change to allow you to function that way? So oppression could fall into a multitude of categories. And I guess maybe I do struggle a little bit with figuring out how to eradicate oppression if it is such a broad term, but I don't know that we're going to at all anyways. I would like to mitigate it legally, if possible, and then go beyond that socially. Like, you know how Dr. Jordan Peterson always says, I don't want to make polyamory illegal. I know about this because I'm an educator in polyamory. Okay, so he says he doesn't want to make it illegal, but he would like society to make the decision to encourage monogamy. That's the same way that I want the world to function, only in the opposite regard, which is everyone's an individual. So if you want to be polyamorous or monogamous, you should do that. So I want it to be a societal shift if the government already has made it so we are legal and on the same playing field. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And in my country, I don't know about the United States, obviously, because I'm not from the America, I'm not from America. But in my country, I would have a very hard time finding any laws or statutes or something like that that would be something you could describe as discriminatory towards a certain group.
Well, sodomy is still illegal in some states. So wouldn't you say that was discrimination until it's off the books, even if it's not enforced?
Okay, but I mean, like I said, I mean, I would be opposed to anti-sodomy laws, for example.
Right, but they have to be taken. So we have to take them off the books, though, so we can actually say we've reached that point. But they're still on the books.
Sure.
So we need to finish.
Yeah, I mean, that's not my decision to make for these people, though. I mean, I'm certainly going to advocate that they shouldn't have sodomy laws. I mean, even not necessarily being concerned about oppressed groups who want to perform sodomy on one another, I'm amazed that anyone would be happy with that kind of level of government intrusion into their lives. I don't think the government should be regulating my sex life, assuming it's happening between two consenting adults.
Yes, of course. No, so we agree on this. So I think what the left, the I don't know if I want to say that on a live show, but the people who haven't yet maybe finished their teens, they get really enthused about things they read and they feel like it makes a lot of sense. And it does make to an extent sense, but the why and the action they take afterwards are not efficient or productive. And I think we can agree on that for the most part. So one of the ways that I've tried to help them understand a little bit better is to give examples like the sodomy law. It's not really enforced, but it is on the books, which means the government still oppresses people's sexual personal interactions as adults, regardless of consensuality. Because well,
if it's not enforced, but it can be. Yeah, it can be.
So,
if it's not, then it's not.
Let me give you a little bit of a different example if this is more helpful because it's actually happening. So I lived in Seattle for 5 years, and Seattle specifically is a technically nude friendly city. Technically. The reason it's technically is they still have on the books that it could be a misdemeanor if you upset the public. But the reason they have that on the books is to protect the citizens from that occasional person. But in general, it's a pretty pro nude city. Now, not everyone knows that. If you haven't lived there, you might not know that. You don't see it often. It's really cold. The point is, even though people can technically do it, they also technically can't. And so what I'm trying to decide is, do we want it to be on the books? Does it need to be on the books? I would argue it might protect citizens over not protecting them, but how would a sodomy law on the books protect people, right? So that's all I'm saying is that you can't say the government is allowing you things if it's literally, if somebody at one point can take me to court and say it's legal for them to do so. So I want to eradicate all laws that do things that really counter personal individual existence. Does that make sense? And then we have basic laws like do no harm. People need to be consenting. People should be adults. We have those laws in place. Those are good laws. I would maintain that in a civil society. Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. But okay, so the nude law, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Why should people be allowed to wander around in public naked?
Well, it's not a matter of should they. It's just the community in Seattle is pro-nude. They have a lot of nudist colonies. They celebrate the solstice. So they all get together, family, friends, kids. It's very family-friendly. And there's a parade and float, and people throughout the year can be naked in the lakes. So it's one of those things where the community as a whole loves it. And they haven't voted against it, but no one's bothered to challenge any laws on the books either because they haven't had to. But that doesn't mean that someone eventually can't use that against the people of Seattle. Does that make better sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So if the community was anti-nude, would you be opposed to that? Would you want them to change?
I think that it makes perfect and solid sense to have designated nude areas. I am a pro, I'm clothing indifferent, so I've been naked lots of times in public. But one of my things is that I would like to do it in a space that isn't traumatizing to other people. So you know what I mean? So if it's allowed, it's allowed. But if it's not allowed, then great. Where is it allowed? And maybe I can advocate for myself to have it more allowed in certain spaces. But I think that's a nice compromise.
Yeah, I think that's a fine compromise.
Cool.
Should we get back to discussing the sort of ins and outs of intersectionality?
Sure, let's do that. I find it
very interesting because intersectionality, from what I see of it, it looks like a way of systematically categorizing every human being on Earth to the point where it becomes prescriptive and it becomes dogmatic and authoritarian and overbearing. I'm not accusing you of these things, but I'm sure that you know that there are plenty of people who do interpret it in this manner, and this is a problem. I think this is antithetical to a free society. Why do you consider yourself a sort of an intersectionalist if you see these problems coming out of it?
I'd like to think that the reason I fell in love with intersectionality was because of Kimberly Crenshaw. I think her ideas of feminism and womanism and the concepts of what it means to acknowledge these things is important. I think the most fascinating thing about being a human is first being able to say, oh, these things are happening or they're not happening, and then to move forward appropriately. I always hear from people in the United States, I'm not, again, sure how it's done in the UK, but I always hear from the people, Christianity is under attack. There are organizations trying to tear us down. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, is there though? Is there oppression towards Christianity? And as an atheist, I want to promote your individual rights, so how can I help you? But then, you know, it's case by case. So the baker was a great example. Christians thought it was a win. I thought it was a win for an individual, like a business owner and an artist. So my thing is,
Christianity is under attack, isn't it? I mean, when they say Christianity is under attack, what they mean is, as a hegemonic cultural force, Christianity is under attack, and it absolutely is, and it should be. So I'm an anti-theist. I would be attacking Christianity if it was in my life.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would be, if I was living in like a Southern American state, I would be a far more militant anti-theist than I am personally. I mean, in my country, 51% of the country is irreligious. It's deeply embarrassing when someone tells you about their religion in this country. So it's not a problem. It's, you know, there's no sort of creeping theocracy outside of Islam in my country. But in the Southern states, I could see why creeping theocracy is a definite problem. And so when they say Christianity is under attack, I mean, why would we say it's not?
Okay, so, well, what I would personally do is I would say, okay, you're under attack. In what ways are we under attack, and in what ways can we help you as individuals? And then I would do that with every group. So if we can agree that Christians can be oppressed, then we can agree that other classes of people can be oppressed, right? So that we acknowledge that to move forward.
Well, any individual can be oppressed. Any person can be oppressed, yeah.
But collective thoughts can also be a targeted group. You know, as an atheist, I try not to be militant about it, because I do believe individuals should have the right to believe in invisible creatures. But I also do believe that they need to acknowledge that that's how I view it. And so they need to learn to live with me. So Christians might be under attack to an extent, but as an atheist, All I know of them is in power. Example, you can't have a non-Christian president, right? Not yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe one day, if we're lucky. We had Kennedy, and that went, well, fabulously, as we all remember. So I would like there to be a moment in time where the United States does represent other religions and doesn't say we're a Christian nation, because we still say that, even though we're a secular nation. And so these types of things tell me Christians are in power. If you can have a cake bake, if the baking issue is like your most prominent issue as a Christian in the United States, then maybe we can talk about that. If you're talking about around the world, Iraq, I'm a Chaldean. Like, we are the Catholics. We are the Christians of the Iraq. If we're talking about that oppression, let's talk about that oppression. But in the United States, Christians as a whole saying they are oppressed, I would like to see the data, and then I would like to help them with that data. The same I would like to do with other group that came to me. As long as they're not harming people.
I don't agree that Christians are oppressed, but we're not talking about what you're talking about is the dominant hegemonic culture that is predominantly Christian, and that is definitely under attack by it was under attack by an organized atheist, anti-theist movement, which had legitimate cause. That it was, I mean, like you said, there are anti-sodomy laws still on the books, so it was completely justified in my opinion and completely right. But Christians can then legitimately say Christianity is under attack, because it is. That was the point. But that's not to say that they're automatically oppressed.
Okay. So let's think about
See, this is the problem, because in my opinion with social justice, it comes inherent. It can't think outside of the dichotomy of oppressed and oppressor. It can't operate without that. It's one majority group has to be the oppressor of another minority group. That has to be the way. And it can't ever envisage a minority group oppressing a majority group, even though that happens all the time. So it's really peculiar to me that it's a worldview that doesn't really accurately represent human interaction. And then it seeks to categorize and sort of formalize every individual, or at least the characteristics about a person that it has a particular interest in. I mean, it never wants to talk about, I don't know, whether blue-eyed people are more privileged than brown-eyed people, you know, things like this. You know,
well, actually, brown-eyed people are more
privileged. They don't have the data.
Well, blue-eyed people actually If you actually do, like, they did studies, and I can't source it, but I thought this was so interesting. They said that if a salesman had blue eyes, he would make more sales or less sales than a brown-eyed person, because most people's mothers have brown eyes. I don't know if that's true, but isn't that fascinating? Like, you're right. We can get it down to the nitty-gritty. I can say I have natural curly hair, and therefore I'm going to be discriminated against. Growing up in the 90s with curly hair, are you kidding me? Like, I was a mess. So I agree with you that these things can boil down to the absolute individual at the end of the day. But because we put laws on the books, at least in America, where it's a group, like, we don't say individual women can't vote. We say women can't vote. So what we're trying to do is just say, hey, instead of, you know, no sodomy, how about you do what you want as long as consensual? And so we're moving towards that. Now, culture, I think, plays a much larger role than the law. Like, the systematic part is a social systematic want and an expectation of behavior. And that's my personal issue. Like, I mean, I could use so many people as an example, but even Brett Weinstein's hesitation towards polyamory was because he didn't know how kids would be socialized. And I'm like, that's so interesting, because as an atheist and more of a libertarian, I think marriage shouldn't even be involved with the government. And then how you raise your kids should be done in an ethical and wholesome way, but there are 20 million different ways to do that in those if you want it to be ethical and wholesome. So it's kind of one of those things where I don't think we can have these conversations about greater groups without getting down to individual cases. And so I think that if I can move intersectionality into that realm where I think it was originally intended, I think we can be in a better place, and where you and I will have more agree on more and come to better compromises. It's why I'm going to be at MythCon. It's why I'm going to be with you guys on stage. I'm totally stoked to have these conversations. And I want the left to have these conversations. Liberalism saved me. Saved my life, because it was so important to who I was as a person. And feminism saved my life as a woman, because I was going through a hard time, and it taught me, you know, all of the things I needed to learn to be successful. And look, I'm successful, so it must have worked for me. So the idea of it for me is there are different philosophy, different thoughts behind feminism. And what I don't understand is why many people really don't know how to have a discussion about it in a little bit more of a complex way. It's not just definitions of words. It's how people take those words and then act on them. Like the leftist progressive friends that they don't talk to me no more because I was nice to the right. And I get that. That's a horrible feeling. It's the same feeling I had when atheists on YouTube left me because I became a feminist. It's the same feeling I had. I have been rejected from every group, which is why I'm a hardcore individualist. So what I'm saying is you're both right and you're both wrong. Because
okay,
it is more complex.
I agree with you that life is phenomenally complex, and this is why fundamentally, I mean, even before taking into account the moral implications of what intersectionality does, I think from a pragmatic view, the practical implications are it's a fool's errand. You're never going to be able to categorize everyone to enough detail to be able to actually encompass them as an individual using an overarching system. And especially because the more complex and interconnected and interlaced the system becomes, the more sensitive people are to even more minute differences, until we are just chasing our own tails to categorize everyone along these lines. And yeah. I mean, that just seems like a totally foolish thing to do, in my opinion.
I think it's necessary like for civil rights. It's a waste of energy.
Yeah. It seems like a waste of energy to me.
Well, you know, and in some ways, if it's done incorrectly, it can be not efficient. And so what I would like to do is add efficiency. I do think, though, in order for certain groups to gain any kind of resemblance to equal playing field of power, they have to move their people in a certain specific way. It's just a chess game, Carl. It's just a game.
Okay.
It's a game, okay, and it's a bunch of people.
Let's hold that thought. Okay. Right. So let's move into the realm of power politics between groups.
Okay.
Because that's what you've just done, right? It's just a game. It's a chess game between groups. What sure. possible argument could there be for white people to give up power to black people?
Oh, as a group?
Yeah.
If you're talking about ethically, it gets a little dicey.
We're talking about power.
Okay. Well, then there is no real reason if you just want power.
Exactly.
But we're not confused. I don't think you and I are confused.
Go ahead.
I mean, you've just reduced the conversation to a chess game, a power play. That's everything about identity politics is just the interaction of power dynamics between groups. And if that's the case, there is absolutely no compelling reason why white people wouldn't just enslave black people once again. Because if, at the end of the day, if black people just want to take power away from white people, power which, let's be honest, in many cases, white people have justly earned. You know, if you're elected to the presidency of your country, how is that unjust? That seems like the most legitimate way of achieving power to me. But if you're going to be denied that or attacked on that ground on the basis that you're white, then why should white people do anything other than attack black people back on the basis that they're black?
Well, I think in America, we were raised. Yeah, I totally get it. So if I may. So talking about America, when people imagine when my parents immigrated from Iraq, they said they were going to have the American dream. They were going to have freedom of choice, freedom of religion. They were going to be Christian and not persecuted. They were going to have all of the things. And as they came here, they started to understand that there were certain rules and expectations of behavior, and they adapted. They did very good as proper little immigrants. They did very well. And they went on to make a business, and they're very successful. They had 10 kids. They contributed to the economy. We all pay taxes, blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that became apparent as their children started to get older was that, hey, you're 10 kids. Well, some of us are gay, and some of us are poly, and some of us are these things. And we would like representation through government. And who became my direct rival was my parents and their belief systems. And so that's when groups need to get together to fight against another dominant group. And that's how it happens. White people just happen to be in power. And there are, I call it black YouTube. There's white YouTube and there's black YouTube. White YouTube's like Richard Spencer, and black YouTube is like the hardcore separatists. And I consider these people valid as American citizens and extreme when it comes to their philosophies. And though I appreciate their input, I am going to decline to participate in funding them or encouraging them, because I think it invalidates the American dream, which is all of us are here to make our own dream. So if there are people telling you can't have that dream, America taught us, go get it. You know?
Okay. I mean, I agree that gay people shouldn't be oppressed, but I don't agree that it should be on the basis of the group that is defined as gay people.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit?
The objection to that. Yeah. The objection to that should, in my opinion, as an individualist, should be based on the infraction of, on the violation of individual rights and individual freedoms. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't really a legitimate argument against homosexuality. The only ones I ever hear come from religion. And as I'm an atheist, I don't take that kind of irrational argument seriously. So to me, there's no justification to suppress homosexuality in any way, shape, or form beyond the usual realm of how we would suppress expressions of heterosexuality, like pedophilia and things like this, rape or that sort of thing. So I don't see why the same rules can't apply. But I don't see that why we would collectivize gay people as an oppressed class. Why that would be something that would be productive to the goal of liberation of gay people.
So we are completely on the same page, and I'm really excited about this, because this means we are totally, like, I agree with you. I find, though, this is a calculated move. This is what other groups had done before us. So the left has to congregate as a group. We fight for groups' rights because, again, laws in the United States aren't made as individuals. They're made as wholes. We can't present that on a ballot that would make sense to religious people. And because religious people are primarily the dominant people in the United States, when we create campaigns for homosexuality, we have to do it on that basis. We have to. Otherwise, we're not going to get through, and it's going to take us another 30, 40 years to actually get to that point. Because the United States, we don't want individuals here. Not really. Oh, go ahead.
Okay, so there's no such thing as group rights in an individualistic democracy. And as soon as you start introducing group rights, you undermine and eventually will destroy the individuality, the individualist nature of that democracy. So, I mean, what I find what you're proposing there really, really dangerous. Very dangerous. Because, I mean, there's no reason that straight people couldn't. I mean, I'm straight and I'm in favor of a gay person's right to have sex with another gay, another man. You know, I don't require any. It doesn't require any group interaction there. What is required is a moral argument over a theocratic argument, and that's not a hard thing to provide. Obviously, living in democracies, you're going to find places where there are people who are particularly set in their ways and particularly conservative, and they're not going to be happy with that. But I think that most of your country is probably pro-gay rights at this point. So I think that you've won the argument. And I think, don't you now have a universal gay marriage in your country?
Yes, but it's constantly being fought. People want to separate California into three states so they don't have to have gay marriage in the South.
Okay.
So we're still fighting people. So we're still fighting people. So what I'm saying is, well, may I ask you then, don't you believe that your ultimate goal, which is I'm all on board for it, is sort of not, we're not here yet. So I understand that you want to live like we're there yet, but we haven't caught up. Systematic, like systems haven't caught up. So how can we get to the point where we've caught up?
Sure. I mean, activism, obviously, you know, the same way everyone else does. But the problem is intersectionality pits groups against one another. And it's not as simple as that. And it's really not as simple as that. I mean, okay, there's no reason that you couldn't have an extremely ideologically diverse section of people who say, we are in favor of gay rights. You can get anarchists, libertarians, communists, feminists, homosexuals, you know, people who aren't necessarily ideologically aligned, but are being physically or legally restrained from having gay intercourse or marriage or whatever. And this coalition of people can be activists in their own way, and they can encourage people and persuade people to use their own various and varied arguments in favor of this from their own ideological positions. But what intersectionality does is it comes along and says, right, I have a mandate to declare that everyone in this group is to be categorized on the basis of their privilege and their oppressions. And now, if you don't operate in the way I want you to operate, I have a pathological sect of activists who are going to come in like steamrollers and attack every single person on the basis of what they perceive to be privileges and oppressions if they don't fall in line. This is naturally going to destroy any movement that it comes into contact with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that intersectionality is actually undermining its own cause. And I think it's a very domineering way to do anything. Seems anti-liberal to me.
I do agree with you that younger generational individuals who have ideas of what intersectionality is might transform it into only being oppression politics. But I would argue that, like, Kimberly Ann Foster, who's another one of my favorite thinkers, she, you know, believes that she's intersectional, and though she's focused on the rights of Black women, she wants to uplift everyone by uplifting and focusing on the people that she can best represent. But that's not to say that her feminism is anti-men or her womanism is anti-anyone who isn't women, or that her intersectionality isn't more than just an acknowledgement. I think at the base, at the foundation of intersectionality, is just an acknowledgement of a system in place. And then it's our jobs, because this was done in 1989. So it made sense more so than, like, there, like, literally LA riots talking about that time, the civil rights movement, like, everything that had just happened. Those are generations of people who had lived through segregation. My mother lived through segregation in Detroit. And it's just like, it's crazy to think how recent it was. And it's funny to me that we think we're so advanced as a species that we think we've just, like, we're still dealing with slavery from when America was first founded. And I want us to give ourselves time. I want humans to just have time to update and come to a conclusion that's a little bit more logical. It's why I'm extremely patient with the religious, because I admire their passion, but I would like there to be logic to our systems.
Okay, so I think my problem primarily is that the politics of identity is the politics of victimhood. I mean, for example, Kimberly Crenshaw was the lady you were citing, yeah? Is that the lady you referenced? Yeah.
Yes, correct.
I mean, does she think that men are oppressing women?
You know, I don't know that. I've only focused on her race oriented work, but
Does she think that white people are oppressing black people?
Systematically, yes.
Well, I mean, what do you mean by systematically?
Systematic social. And the laws are getting eradicated as we move forward. And keep in mind, I don't know all the laws and books. This isn't my realm of expertise in that particular regard to U.S. law. But from my understanding, there are still laws, loopholes in the law, just like the sodomy laws, that do keep people who are classified as brown or other in certain categories of value. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure those laws aren't actually a reflection of societal interaction. And that, I think that's my worry, right? We don't want people to be treated unfairly. The cake bake guy is my favorite. Jack Phillips. He's my favorite because people right away were very mad at me. And they're like, he's not baking a cake for that, those gay people. And I said, no.
Sorry, do you mind? I don't want to go off on a tangent. Yeah. I take it you can't think of any particular examples where white people are institutionally, systemically oppressing black people. Because, I mean, when I look at I've been to America a few times now, probably about 6-7 times. I've been to the East Coast, West Coast, and I've been to Milwaukee. I don't know what that counts as. And I saw a lot of black people just getting along with their lives. It doesn't look like they're oppressed to me at all. And so when people say, black people are being oppressed, they're usually talking about, we could just call them ghettos and thug culture that comes out of them. But that's not in any way unique to black people at all. That's a consequence of poverty and fatherlessness. And it's a consequence of young men being poorly raised by single mothers, frankly.
Yeah.
And so at no point really can you point to that and say that's white people's fault.
Well, but if... And keep in mind, again, I feel like if you look at U.S. history, and I know many intersectional feminists will say this, or feminists in general, it's not that hard to see that there was an epidemic of anti-blackness that brought around, like, literally directly laws that would keep... It was the drug issue. Okay, this is really weird history, and I'm not the best at name places or things, so make fun of me all you want. But here we go. So there was a time where the KKK and white supremacists were still very embedded in our police system. And from my understanding of how it went down, there were moments where they said, well, let's put people of color in prison for longer sentences for the same crimes. And it became a system, right? We look at that now. We have case by case. We can take it as individual as you want. Case by case. Now, I think we're getting stuck on semantics for systematic. Well, I think systematic is the word here that harms everyone.
Yeah, but I think you're mistaking the outcome of the system for the intention of the system. So how exactly does the historical interface between the police and the KKK prevent black people in 2018 from getting married?
No, they can get. They got. What do you mean? They were able to get married in the 1960s.
No. Black people have always been able to get married.
Interracial and stuff. Well, interracial wise.
Yeah, I'm not talking about interracial. I'm talking about within the black community, between black people, because it seems to me that the problem with black communities is a complete lack of marriage, because black families who marry have an average of around $66,000 income to the household per year. And that's very comparable to white families who marry. You get about $75,000. So there's not that much in that. And yet black households who are not married, single parent households, the average is about $33,000 a year. And you can see just on the face of it exactly where the poverty is coming from and where the problems are stemming from, especially when, I know from my own personal experiences as a child that young men need their fathers to keep them in line. There's no getting around that. And I actually put up a video today where I featured black women in the video saying, well, we need more male presence in our communities. So I think even black women are now starting to catch on. Well, actually, maybe having the father around is a lot easier way of keeping these rowdy young men in check. And so at no point can you point to any racism that's the problem there. It seems to be the personal decisions of the people in these communities. Do you see my point?
To an extent, so we can say that as individuals, I've made decisions to stay in certain places, but an individual isn't just who they are in that moment. They are a history of their existence. They are a tradition of their families before them. And I do believe these things matter. I believe what you offer to your next generation of kin will carry on. And if you give them misinformation or negative, wrong information, they will carry that on through the generations. It's why we still have flat earthers who continue making babies and continue. It's like, okay, no. We need to stop.
They're a new phenomenon. You didn't used to have flat earthers
everywhere.
I actually really agree with you that the situation that you inherit definitely determines strongly influences the course of your life, which to me seems like an even bigger argument for black communities taking responsibility for their own problems when it comes to marriage. Because during the pre-civil rights era, I only know this off the top of my head because I did it in a video today, but black marriage rates were very comparable to to white marriage rates. I mean, 78% of households were a married couple in the black community in 1950, whereas today it's something like 23%. And if you're being born into a situation like that, you're being born deliberately, like intentionally almost, into a situation where you have been given severe disadvantages. I mean, not only are you going to be poor, you're going to have to live in a poor area, you're going to have access to poor schools, you're going to know other poor people around you, you're going to have no real good examples of how to be a functional adult, especially as I can't even imagine, I'm a father and I'm married, and I can't even imagine how difficult it is to raise a child single-handedly. I mean, I have enough trouble with dealing with my wife. And so, like, I completely agree with you that what you inherit is a bad thing, but I think something that you inherit from the previous generation is far more important and has a far greater influence over the course of your life than something that happened 150 years ago or 70 years ago or something like that. It seems to be making excuses, is what I mean.
And I mean, my audience knows that I don't tolerate many excuses. I will tolerate an acknowledgement of the struggle that you have endured and your past, but now we have to start being efficient about how you're going to get successful. But I do not in any way disregard their statements of systematic oppression through socialization or through expectation of behavior, because I think it's extremely valid. I just don't think it needs to be this way always. And I think in order to fight that, you have to know the system to fight the system, not just be anti the system. Like someone, they always ask me, well, as a feminist, are you a socialist or a capitalist? I was like, where do I live? And they were like, America. I was like, that I guess I'm a fucking capitalist. Because at the end of the day, I don't have qualms with how a system works as long as I can function within it, learn its rules, and learn when I can break them or move away from them or adapt into a different culture. That's my theory. But that's because maybe because I'm an immigrant or my parents are immigrants. So maybe I have that immigrant mentality. Like, oh, Saddam's killing all the Christians. Peace out. We're going to go to America. But that's not to say that we didn't lose Iraq in the process. We had to let it go. And that makes me sad that it can't be a better place like it was 50 years ago or before Saddam was in power. I think you and I agree more than we probably disagree. I think we disagree on methods, and I think we disagree on possibly, maybe I should say, I say I'm an intersectional feminist if it helps people, by just stating I acknowledge that I think that theory is pretty freaking valid. How we want to implement the theory is very different. And that is where I do move more away from the left. And I'm more of a liberal.
Sorry to interrupt again, but like, okay, so you still defaulted back to talk about the systems and socialization of the black communities. Who is doing the socializing if not the black people themselves?
Well, so that does play a huge role. One's understanding of their place in existence is derivative of the majority culture. And the majority of culture is white culture. And that's totally fine. And I'm not talking negatively about that. But what I'm saying is that matters. Just like straight culture is the dominant, I learned as a young queer person, I wasn't accepted and I was different. I even learned that about my features as a young child in school. So what I did as I was getting older was I learned to adapt, and I learned in what ways I was different so I could learn in what ways that mattered. And I think what happens is that we disregard people's personal stories or what they're telling us, because we think, well, we didn't go through that, so how could you be going through that? But they're telling you right now they're going through it. So it's our job to decide how much of our resources we're going to invest into this person's existence. And then will it help the greater society by doing it? And I do think by uplifting black people and minorities, our world will be better. I don't think we need to shit on white men. I'm sorry, guys. You're just not special enough for me to spend my time shitting on you. You are perfectly decent individuals. And as a whole group, I'm not going to sit here and just like, it's not my, you know what I mean? Unless you consensually want to negotiate for King Saint, then we'll talk. But that's just the kind of stuff that for me, that's how I live my life, which is acknowledging systems work and then acknowledging how to get above the system. Do you feel like you're not, I don't know. I feel like I'm disappointing you a little bit. Should I not be, okay. Should I be a little angrier or like, I think we just have a lot more in common. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure we do. I'm very interested in the way you think about these things. So when you say that the dominant culture is white, I don't agree. I think that if you went into one of these black ghettos, the dominant culture would be anything but white. It would be anti-white. It would be an open rejection of white people. And I think that if I went into one of these ghettos, I would be in physical danger because of this rejection of white people. What do you think?
Okay, so I just found where we're kind of miscommunicating. So let me do that first. So I think in pockets of the United States, absolutely. When you go into certain specific places, you will 100% be under duress or threat. As a system, what I'm talking about is like media, white culture, you know, decides clothing, you know, decisions. Okay, okay. A lot of the artists are white.
Sorry to interrupt. I should have been more specific about this. Okay, so do you spend a lot of time watching World Star Hip Hop?
No.
No.
I don't watch reality TV.
World Star's a website where they upload videos of people fighting a lot, and that's my knowledge of it. But when you say media, what you're talking about is what you perceive to be the dominant culture, but that's only because that's what you watch. If you don't watch any of these things, then you won't perceive that to be the dominant culture. If you don't explore these things, you won't experience them. And I don't think that many people in these ghettos do explore these things. I think they do. I think they're quite parochial in that way. I think they don't have a particularly broad outlook, which is why they tend to get trapped in this kind of ghetto situation. That's what they know. That's what they expect the world to be. And they don't have very broad horizons. And so I don't think that you can say, well, the dominant culture is white, look at the media, therefore, because I just don't think it's an accurate representation of what the people who actually live in these situations are actually imbibing during their daily experiences. So this is the problem. This is the problem I have with like systematic thinking like this. It's very inaccurate. Sure. I mean, like the very term social justice, I don't even think it has a real definition. And I don't think that anyone can ever point out how you can have a social justice. All justice, in my opinion, has to be individual. It's impossible to have group justice because not all members of a group are the same. And in fact, you'll specifically be privileging people within a group who don't deserve to be privileged, and oppressing people within a group who don't necessarily want you to do what you're doing just by treating them as a group. So you're creating injustices by just approaching it like a group. So this is, I guess, the difference in our thinking here.
What is a group of individuals when huddled together?
Well, it depends how you're looking at them and how you're defining them, doesn't it? I mean, like, you can get a voluntary association of people who join a golf club or something. And I mean, for example, in Britain, right, we've got a long history of what are called unincorporated trusts, which are just groups of people who have a shared interest and who do things along that interest. I mean, and they can get things done. Like this is the advantage of common law, which, but coming from English common law, for example, like the Anglers Trusts all through the early 20th century, the Thames, the River Lee,
I'm sorry, Carl, it's paused for me. Is it paused for anyone else?
No, he has paused, yes. And there goes, he's back.
Yep. Up. Using English contracts, using lawsuits.
You're breaking up. Sorry, Carl. You're breaking up pretty bad there.
Sorry about that. Okay, so the Anglers Trust managed to clean up the Thames against industrialists using English common law just by freedom of association and their willingness to associate as a group of people. But that was by choice, you know. But as soon as you say, well, okay, this is the declaration for gay people or black people, a black person who opposes you is, in by your definition, some kind of Uncle Tom. Because, and this is why I went to Berkeley and I saw these far left protesters and I asked them, why are there so many non-white people in the white supremacy group over there? And the guy just was just like, they're Uncle Toms. Just that was it. It's like, so yeah, that's a complete negation of their personality, their agency, their identity. They're traitors to the cause. Because when you start introducing everything into the politics of group identity, it's the politics of power and it's the politics of victimhood. And there can be no negotiation between the two groups. It's just a 100% win, a 100% lose situation.
So this is where I think, okay, so I hold myself up to my ideal standard constantly, which means if I didn't believe in identity politics, I would never reference it as a real or even joking thing. And that's a little bit of my confusion, because in reality, individuals in a group is called a collective. If a bunch of atheists get together to fight for our rights, we are a fucking identity collecting group. One of the things that I thought was kind of cute is that you did a speech a couple days ago on a live stage. I think I even had some friends who were there, which was kind of fun. And you made a joke by like, look at all these white males. That kind of stuff is interesting to me because I know you don't believe in identity politics and I know you're making a joke. It's literally, I get it, hashtag joke. But I guess my worry as somebody who's trying to be a better thinker is I'm trying to also display better attitudes and contributions to society. So what I'm asking is, if you don't believe in identity groups, then why do we start off our speeches making fun of that idea, but then celebrating it? Dave Rubin did that when he had Blair White on and Candace Owens and cracked me up. He's like, look, I'm gay, you're black, you're trans. And I'm like, that's identity politics. It's fine. It's fine. There's nothing unethical about identity politics. The way you implement it is what's unethical.
Okay.
Right? Like, there's nothing inherently wrong with it acknowledging.
There is something inherently wrong to it.
There's something wrong with saying that I have curly hair or that I have hazel eyes or that I am from this ethnic background.
I will explain. There's nothing wrong with being something, obviously. You know, obviously there's nothing wrong with being what you are. But politicizing certain aspects of yourself, especially immutable ones, especially when you suggest that the category of identity should be encompassed for everyone with this identity, then you're laying claim to the beliefs of other people that you don't know and you've never met and who often will oppose you on those grounds. So what you're doing is inherently tyrannical. Yeah.
Okay, so we agree in that way. If this is, I just want to make sure I'm on the same page. You're saying, like, as a white man, I don't want to be assumed my beliefs or anything about me because I'm a white man.
Yeah, but yes. I also don't want. Okay. Yeah, but let's go with that.
Okay, so I agree with you. I don't want people to assume things of me because I am a woman. What happens, though, is that we make assumptions. There's stereotypes that exist, and every person is conditioned with bias and prejudice, and that's fine. Like, it's not like it's fine. It's a part of our world, our worldview. So I guess my challenge to that would be to say, well, if we can acknowledge that it exists and it gets treated down from generation to generation, then in order to have activism that people understand, you would form it into groups and identity. Now, you and I do agree, though. We went from, hey, my group over here needs some rights and stuff. Is that fine? To, if you are not a part of this group, you are literally against us and you are a bad person. That is illogical. There's nothing objectively factual.
I don't agree with that.
You don't think the left does that? No group needs rights.
No, the left do that. But the way you're formulating that, no group needs rights. The people who make up the groups need rights. And this is why I think that we should
return to interest politics.
Sorry?
Okay. Well, before you explain that, could you just tell me what a country would look like with a law on the books that kept we acknowledge that children shouldn't be considered adults till they're 18 for the most part in America. Mm. But children as a group get rights and people as adults get rights, but you don't want them to be identified that way? Or does that work? Is that okay?
Children as individuals have rights. Children as individuals have rights. The group that is children don't have rights.
That's not how America works.
I think it is.
But it isn't. You can think that, but it isn't.
I don't know. How is it different?
So, because the way we create law, when we're making legislation, we form it based off of a group. This group needs to be protected. This group within these parameters needs to be protected.
No, but that's not always true. I mean, like, for example, like a speeding fine, speed limits aren't group based. There isn't a group of people who are speeders who go really fast down motorways. They're not a group of people. That's an action that anyone can take. And so you're creating a universal law that's for everyone. And that's how just laws are created. And yeah, there are exceptions. Certain things are only applicable to children or to adults because of the fundamental nature of human biology and the necessity that's created by that. But we agree that there's no necessity created on homosexuality, being black, gay, whatever, any of the other like arbitrary characteristics in being female. So there's no reason to create a law that would specifically target women or gays or blacks. And so you don't have group identity in your law. You have universal laws.
But we don't, because the gay thing is a great example. It's not that men and women or humans are being denied marriage. It's that two people who follow this category, which is then homosexuality, gets rejected. A group gets rejected.
That's no longer in the case in the US, is it?
For now.
Well, that's going to be rolled back?
There are people who are actively working for it. And if honestly, like if Trump is going to take away Planned Parenthood and defunding for pro-choice rights, I don't see why it wouldn't be wrong to assume he would cater to those people who are anti-gay marriage, who are still primarily religious and the majority is religious.
I don't think he's going to do that. I really don't think he's going to do
that. You know what? And honestly, like maybe he won't, maybe he will. He already talked about trans not being applicable for the military just for being trans. As a group, he denied them. Not individual trans people, but as a group, he denied them rights. Yeah. So I want to stay away from that. I would like there to be, but right now, in order to function as a...
Hang on, let's stop there, because this is another thing I find that left-wing people do, is they tend to define a right as whatever they're holding in the front of their mind at that time. You don't have a right to join the military. Okay, you don't have a right to join the military. You might have a duty to join the military. You might have an opportunity to join the military. You don't have a right to join the military. And we agreed on that.
So we can agree on that. But trans people were allowed to join, did join, and then got kicked out after. So they changed the rules.
That's not
a right,
is it? Yeah, but that's not a right, is it?
But they had a right when they first enlisted, and they had a contract, and their contract is... No, they didn't have
a right. That wasn't a right. No one has a right to join the military.
So maybe we're defining rights differently. Rights are just things that I think the culture has deemed acceptable. I don't think they're inherent. Okay, there's no God.
Yeah, or there is no God. There's no God, that even if there's no God, that doesn't mean they're not inherent.
What is... Okay, so I... Okay, let me just... Brittany's philosophy. Okay,
the easiest way to define what a right is to do a thought experiment. Put a man on an island. What can he do? What can't he do? They're his rights.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello?
Okay, he's back.
Yeah, so...
Okay, he's back.
Yeah, sorry, it's probably my internet connection. I'm really sorry.
But that's okay. No problem.
A right is just what you can do without infringing on someone else's personal rights themselves. So, I mean, for example, being free speech absolutists, I don't think that anything I say is capable of damaging your rights. And I'm sure you don't think that anything you say can damage my rights, which is why we're both free speech absolutists, right? Mm-hmm. But it's because it's something inherent to you. It's an inherent way that you can act without infringing, without damaging someone else, and that shouldn't be restrained. And this is why, like, you know, for example, I do think that people should have the right to be able to be, have, you know, to get married, to have homosexual marriage, things like this. You know, these are things that two people can innately do that there would otherwise be no hindrance to. But I mean, you don't have a right to join a military, because then we would, I mean, this is the whole problem I have with positive rights in the first place. If a military doesn't exist, what do you do about your right to join the military? You've got to create a military, don't you? I mean, like, it's silly.
If we can just work within the realm of what is real. So the United States had a military in place. People were allowed to join who were trans. They joined. They had a contract saying you were in the military for 4 to 6 years or 10 years or 20, whatever. Yes. And then the president goes on Twitter and insinuates that they're going to do this thing they haven't done yet, but they're looking into doing it. How is he not violating the contract?
I'm aware of what he did.
Right. So my question is, so Brittany's philosophy is that we are just little specks, right? We came to be, we have consciousness, and that's beautiful. But the only way we are able to do the things we do is based off our understanding of what culture we were raised in. So rights inherent, it's just whoever's more powerful really gets to decide the legality of your ability as a free person. We are not completely free. We will never have a free society. We will have an understanding that these are group like laws we've put together to protect us as a whole and to make us efficient. Right.
Let me stop you there, because what you're doing there is legitimizing the tyrannical regime that your parents fled from. Rights are inherent to human beings. This is liberal philosophy 101. And this is where we draw the distinction between free societies and non-free societies. This is why we consider these societies to be worse than our own, because they do suppress people's rights. And this is why we are surely human rights activists, to protect the rights of people who are being oppressed in our own societies. And you saying, well, rights are only what the person in power gives you, that's just tyranny. That's just a justification for tyranny and saying, right, I mean, that means there's no justification to end slavery with that line of logic.
So in order for me to kind of communicate this philosophy, it would be, so there's the ethical realm, which we should all live in. And then there's the realm of, do we want just power? If humans just want power, there are plenty of unethical ways to do that. There are also plenty of ethical ways to make it so many people have power. So if we're talking about, like, I'm not sure, because I don't believe in any that we're special, I suppose, but I'm not sure that we have the right to technically, I'm not sure that you can say that humans as animals, because I think we're animals, have an inherent right to breathe, except that we decided as intellectuals we should have the right to believe or breathe. But we had to make that decision. Had to be consciously made. Do you know what I mean? So if you don't know that.
Okay, what you're saying there is that animals don't have an inherent right to life, and I think they do.
Well, I think
the people have. Personally. Because
sorry, This is the thing, right? What?
Well, okay, so, I mean, for them not to have the right to be able to breathe, someone would have to stop them from breathing.
Right.
So if they were on their own in a state of nature, they would have the right to breathe and no one would be able to take that away from them.
Right. Because so maybe it's just the words I'm using. I do agree that we have like basic rights based off of based on what's accessible to us. But those things have to be accessible to you. So if he lived on an island, he would have the right to then be whoever he wanted to be on that island, unless that island was already occupied. Then he'd have to probably understand the structure of which he's been brought into.
You believe in positive rights. That's what you believe. As in negative rights of freedom from, positive rights of freedom to. As in you should have a right. Right, okay. But again, that's contingent on a contextual situation. So if there is no military, then you don't have the right to join it. Then you don't actually have that right. So what you're actually referring to wasn't a right, it was a privilege. Because a right is something inherent to you. I mean, that's why they defined it that way in your constitution.
I'm going to be completely different. I don't really understand the difference if there's an island or a military. It's the same thing for me. Either society tells me I can join or I have to act a certain way, but society makes those rules up. Trans people aren't inherently, they don't have the right to serve, but they were told under the law that they could, and then they were denied that access afterwards.
Okay,
so I don't understand. Right,
it was just open to trans
people. But they qualify. They qualify. Yeah,
because of the criteria that we've already laid out. But if you change the criteria, then they don't qualify. For example, I don't qualify to join the NBA because I'm only 5'9" and I'm not very athletic. I don't have a right to join the NBA, even though the NBA exists. And even if 10 years ago, the NBA was like, yeah, we're going to take average height, fat neck beards. Then if they change that, then I don't have the choice.
Right. So trans people do not have the right, unless it was accessible to them to join, unless they qualify. Now, if they want to change the system, they can say that. If somebody who is 5'9" wanted to join the NBA, then change the rules. But there are rules in place for a reason.
Yeah. It's still not a right. It's just an ability. It's a privilege.
I don't understand how existence doesn't operate under that way either then. Because we form communities, we form laws. I guess I'm a little lost on how humans in general, we don't have like a right to be, we don't have a right to choose if we're born, right? So then we're born and we're here and we have to accept the fact that we exist. And then you have to accept the fact that you exist within certain understandings of culture, depending on where you're born. And then you, in America, you're told that if you want things, you have to advocate for it. So people went and said, hey, I want a right or a privilege of being a part of this particular activity. And that's what they're doing. So we agree on that, right? I'm on the same page.
Absolutely.
I haven't lost anybody.
Absolutely. Okay. But the problem with using the term right is that it actually has a specific philosophical definition. It means something. You know, it's genuinely important. And this is something that the left does all the time, is just exchange the word right for the word ability. And your abilities aren't always constant, and they're not inalienable.
So let me retract my statement, because we obviously do agree. I just may be using the wrong terminology.
I know I sound like I'm getting hung up on the semantics, but the thing is, as you actually like drill down to the specifics, and like this is why I asked you what your definition of oppression was, because it was way broader than any definition of oppression I'd be content to use. And as soon as we both understand like the underpinnings of what we're saying, suddenly a lot of the things that have been built upon these kind of misconceptions just fall away.
I do think we're on the same page. I will say, this is my first time doing this, by the way. I've never really been on like a back and forth with someone. Thank you. Most of the conversations I have do last many, many hours because we do get hooked up on semantics. And I do think that's the problem with communication. And so we just went back and forth for like 5 minutes on something that we actually are probably on the same page on. It took me a second to get the same language. So if we could broil it down to, I guess, that point. Sorry, my cat really wants to sit on my lap right now. But if we can have this issue here, then I assume it's going to happen in the greater sphere of understanding and conversation. So what I'm just trying to do is offer people an ability to kind of dissect and then come to a better understanding and compromise when we interact. So I would love to live in a free country where individuals really do matter. I would love that. I don't have a better method of getting there except by promoting underrepresented people to have voices, and without disparaging the majority. I do not advocate or promote the negative wording towards white people as a whole. That's ridiculous. But I do want to say that I do think that there is a lot of valid concern for minorities who need opportunity, and this is how they think they need to get it, because everyone else has been telling them for years, you're not going to get it any other way. So they're trying to be loud and proud about it. I mean, I can't really fault them for really wanting rights.
Okay. So, okay. Is Oprah Winfrey a minority?
Yes.
Is she underprivileged?
No longer.
No longer.
No, so, she's so the first female billionaire on television, right?
Sure. So why are you advocating for Oprah Winfrey?
Oh, so something that, from my limited understanding of like womanism or understanding of basic intersectionality, is that when we say we're fighting for Black women, we can't actually say we're fighting for every single Black woman, but an understanding of how the system sees Black women as a whole. So obviously we don't know every individual story of every Black woman, but we can say as a whole, it seems the system might forget they exist in some realm. So maybe we can help them, or maybe why aren't they going to colleges, or maybe what, you know what I mean? That's how we tackle these ideas. At least I do. So it's not that Oprah is oppressed as an individual. It's just that prior to her becoming a billionaire, she most certainly was, as a woman on television and as a Black representation in media. Her story is amazing. You should definitely watch the doc.
There's a reason I brought her up, but
please.
Okay, so you think that before she was a billionaire, she was oppressed?
I believe she faced a lot of oppression. Yeah, from her story. Yeah, her story is really
crazy. I mean, poverty and whatnot, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Classism. But it wasn't to do with the fact she was Black, was it?
Well, I think classism is a direct directly reflects onto race in America. So I don't think you can say classism in racism. You can say both, they exist separate and they overlap, just like many other things, honestly. Just because you're polyamory doesn't mean you're open relationship, but they can overlap. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's the same thing. Race and classism. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they exist and they also on occasion will overlap. Absolutely.
Yeah. But this is why it's worth distinguishing and not really very productive to say, well, I'm for minority women, because then you're not taking into account classism. It wasn't a very useful vector in the first place. If you're advocating for the rights of Michelle Obama, you know, she's fine. But this is the problem with taking people as groups. It's the problem with this is why Hillary Clinton, one of the most powerful women in the world, sitting there going, "Oh, it's because I'm a woman." It's like, no, you can't play the woman card because you're Hillary Clinton. Your particular privileges and set of life circumstances make you like the envy of men, of almost every man who has ever lived, would love to have the sort of power and influence that Hillary Clinton had. And the fact that she can then use identity politics, go, "Oh, well, let me whip out my woman card." It's like, it's a smokescreen. It's not true. It's a nonsense, you know?
Well, so I do consider Hillary Clinton is a pioneer for women. When she was younger, there were many, many challenges for women to have representation in law. She moved through. She has an incredible political career, regardless of how you feel about her politics. I mean, the woman has done things. She has, you know, an amazing resume. I will say the thing about Hillary that makes her sort of being able to pull the woman card when she first ran against Barack Obama was the media coverage was obviously sex biased. She had this moment where she cried and she said, "I'm just really worried for the country." And I remember the news ran with that as like, "Look at, she's unstable. She's a woman. Are we sure this is what we want?" And it became this narrative that I heard I was very conservative at one point in my life. I've met Glenn Beck. I've been on Rush Limbaugh's show. Like, I've met Sean Hannity. I was very conservative at one point in my life. And that's the stuff that we were taught. It's the stuff that we were told. I wrote a whole book when I was a conservative about how women can never be president because periods, hashtag, oh my God. So it's one of those things where there is an idea and a culture that reminds people of their place. And what we're doing is challenging that status and that quota, that understanding of stereotypes. We saw it with Trayvon Martin's death. He was a kid doing what most kids do, but the justifications for his death from people were amazing. And all of them had to do with what kid walks in the rain with a hoodie on. I'm like, every kid ever. But that was amazing to me. And that I think was inherent bias on their opinions, because their own sons would do those things. They didn't say anything about it. So it's a disconnect. It's not malicious. It's not even cruel. To be completely honest, I think it's just a disconnect. It's a misunderstanding of experience.
Going back to the Hillary Clinton crying thing, I find that very interesting. Do you think that the electorate would have been accepting of Barack Obama crying about, like, the future of the country, having a little sob? Do you think that would have improved his campaign?
You know what's interesting is I did think about that after I witnessed Glenn Beck crying at a conference around all these masculine conservative men. Bear with me here, I got a point. And I remember saying, like, are we anti-men crying? Is it men crying like they're pussies? And everyone was like, yeah, but Glenn's a conservative, so maybe he's crying for real. It's not like liberal tears. So there's obviously bias in media. And I love, like, as much as I love Fox News with good popcorn, it's a bias. I think Barack would have gotten masculine.
That's the thing. I mean, Glenn Beck, I mean, everyone's surely seen the video of him putting on the fake tears, right? When Glenn Beck does it, yeah, exactly. It's an affectation.
Right. Let me answer your question.
Okay.
Just watching the media play its game, I 100% guarantee you Barack Obama would have been painted as a weak man, but not a weak black man.
Sure, but that's because Obama was a weak man.
Definitions. You think he was a weak man?
Strong. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, physically strong?
Physically and politically. Very weak.
Oh, I favored him as a man in general. I favored his ideas. But, okay, that's fine.
His ideas were necessarily bad, but I think that he was just not a strong leader. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to give an example of how he was. But, this is the thing, like... The top position in your country is the top position in the world. Someone who's going to break down and have a little bit of a sob isn't appropriate for that position at all.
I disagree. As a future therapist, once I finish school, I actually think crying is a perfectly natural and wonderful instinct that evolution gave us. It's a present that they gave us to release tension, to release stress, to reset. Sure. I think it's an amazing tool to mourn. I think sometimes when you eat really spicy food, it's nice when water comes down your face. It's a cooling mechanism. Like, there's all these beautiful things. I try to look at it as a positive versus a negative, and then I try to move forward. There are plenty of reasons why...
That's the thing. It also is a negative. Those things might be true for you as an individual, right?
Socially, it can be a negative.
Yeah, and you're the leader of the free world. You have a massive social responsibility, and to be seen being so weak as to cry on TV, that is not inspirational. That is not something that is going to give anyone, and especially your enemies, any kind of pause for thoughts. You know, that's not going to make them think that America is what it deserves to be, where it should be, and it's definitely staying the course. And that in and of itself is
you're worried about marketing versus authenticity. That's fine.
No, I'm worried about politics there. I'm worried about I don't want anything to buy anything. It's what they will think, regardless of what I want them to think. So
you want us to buy? No, we want Americans. We want people outside of America to buy the fact that we're big and bad and scary, and we're going to nuke you at any moment. We want people to buy that idea so they remain afraid of us. But it's a gimmick. It's like it's true. We are powerful. Yeah. We're going to possibly smartly avoid nuclear war if possible, but we still have to threaten like we're going to hit the button. Okay. Hopefully, we don't.
Kim Jong Un, his nuclear program has fallen apart. Like, he's nuked one of his own cities, his test site's in ruins, it's in a radiated mess. They have no... I'm so tired of Americans talking about nuclear war with North Korea. But it's not going to happen. I mean, no one's going to engage in a nuke fight with America. It's not going to happen.
That's great. That's great news for all of us.
Yeah, and so it's not nukes that you have to think about, right? What it is about is your conventional Army and Navy and Air Force. And when you actually look at America's Army, Navy, and Air Force, it's unbelievable. Like, the British Empire used to operate on something called the two-power standard. So they would, like, add up the French and Russian navies and say, right, these are the two nearest competitors. If our Navy is as big as them combined, then we will comfortably remain the world hegemon, peace through strength, right? the United States has almost a world power standard, as in the United States spends almost as much as the entire rest of the world combined on their military, which means the United States, from a military perspective, is definitely prepared to go to war with literally everyone to maintain its position of dominance. And the United States is so unbelievably more dominant than any of these other power. I just can't stand hearing the left talk about anything to do with the United States geopolitical influence, because you guys are wildly out of touch with how reality is. The US is the most powerful nation that has ever been. And so, like, yes, you have nothing to fear there, but part of power is perception. Like you say, marketing, I suppose you call it. And if you have a leader like Obama, who you know is not going to use this military, because he wasn't going to use the military, he was going to use drones to kill randos in Pakistan, but there was no way he was going to authorize an invasion of Russia, is there, if the need arose? And what happened? Putin whipped him on the international stage. Putin absolutely just kept pushing and pushing and pushing, to the point where, I mean, Obama didn't have a red line left, did he? And so this is why, unfortunately, your president can't be seen on TV crying. I'm sorry, and I'm saying this as not someone who's an American. I'm saying this as someone who thinks that it's a good thing for the world to have an English-speaking hegemon with a history from English common law, from individualism, from liberalism, to be the dominant world power. That is a good thing for everyone on Earth. So you have the Americans have a responsibility to maintain a president who has a backbone, which is why I've become an even stronger supporter of Trump than I was back when I was just opposing Hillary. He at least has the stones. And you guys, I hate watching the left undermine him in this regard. When your president gets out there and does something on the world stage, you should be in full-throated support of him, no matter how you feel about the guy.
I'm going to be honest, I've never held that belief, mostly because I'm a registered independent. So I've never been a Democrat. I've never just voted for parties. I don't just promote people because they're my leaders. I hold them accountable. I'm sorry.
In general,
you said you the left, and I wasn't sure if you meant me the left or like you the left. Okay, so I wasn't sure.
I just meant the left. But
sure. The only thing with Trump, I would like him to be held accountable, and I would like him to see. I would take crying over the buffoonery of his tweets. Yeah, personally, because she cried once. Yeah, but he tweets every day.
Bringing peace to the peninsula. You know, his like. You need to think more. Like you wanted to bring identity politics into the realm of power politics, but as soon as you go into international politics, you seem to be able to abandon that frame of mind completely. But imagine that frame of mind in international politics, and then think, do you want your country to look weak and vulnerable? And the answer is just no, mm-hmm. obviously.
So, really fast, my realm of specialty is not international politics because I'm not well-versed in a lot of foreign governments. Sure. My focus is how to make Americans have more civility and kindness towards one another with strong backbones, because I still am like that conservative cowgirl in my heart. And I want people to be fierce and strong and stand up for themselves. I want them to cry if they need to. And when you're done, you can come talk to me. And those are the kinds of things that I do believe there needs to be leaders in leader positions. But I do not think a woman crying once should disqualify her from being a leader when 99% of the time she met the same criteria as the men who were running against her. And I think that Trump needs to be also held accountable for his childish behavior, which I don't think is very dignified, but that's maybe my standard of dignity is maybe just a little different than other people's.
I agree with you. Okay, so Hillary Clinton can cry all she wants in private. That's sure. Fine. I don't care. You know, I also agree with you that, you know, they are just people. Everyone has to have a cry sometime, you know, and that's fine. Sure. That's absolutely fine. But when you have a role to play in public, you want to be the leader of the free world. You've got a duty to maintain a certain kind of gravitas. And I agree with you that yes. Trump's Twitter presence is rarely doing this. As silly as it is, it's not doing it. But do you not think that, I mean, I don't want to get onto Trump really, but you can see why the adversarial nature of the left, I mean, it's pathological, the hatred of Donald Trump at this point. Like, I mean, for example, 6 months ago, when Trump was tweeting ravenously at Kim Jong-un, I saw lots of sort of verified lefty journos almost sympathizing with Kim Jong-un, you know, like defending Korea, defending him from Trump. And I found that really strange because, and for exactly the reason we're seeing now, as soon as Trump starts making friends with him, which he is doing, we see, well, Kim Jong-un's a dictator and all this. And of course he is, you know. But why weren't you saying that 6 months ago? And really it's because it was just partisan politics. It was just you fighting for the team and he was the other team.
At the end of completely.
With my friend. And I'm not saying you do this, obviously. And it's something that it's a real pathology in America that just, I mean, it's everywhere, but it's really bad in America. It's really bad. And a lot of it, I think, stems from this kind of identity politics, because ultimately it is the politics of victimhood. Like, I can't see how you can empower people by approaching them as if they're the victims. So
I'm going to say something.
Would you guys be willing, Brittany can have a last word. Would you guys be willing to take some questions?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm down. Is Carl, do you have time? Okay. So yeah. I'm going to say something that I know is going to sound extremely offensive, but I want people to hear me when I say it. I don't think most people have a great, deep, and thorough understanding of their belief systems. And what I pose to everyone on the left, right, or middle is to, if you're going to confront me especially, I would like to know the logical reasoning, because there must have been a moment you came to that made you go, oh, this is what I'm fighting for. And what I don't want you to do is become another label that you have to be identified by your whole life. You are not labels. Your life is defined by labels because that's how the world works, but you are not defined by your labels. And that's what I want people to remember. Learn the game, live the game. Learn to live outside of it when you want. But if the world is going to run through labels, then I don't know what other method to use to get above it, you know?
I got nervous there when you said controversial, but that is probably the least controversial thing that's been said on this show. So
yeah, I completely agreed with every single word of that. So that was a controversial to me.
Let me make it a little bit more controversial. Okay. To my young leftist liberals that I love with all of my heart and joy, I am here for you through all of your tears. And when you're done crying, let's get some shit done, okay? So here, is that a little bit? I feel like that's still.
I think we have different definitions of what controversial means.
Oh, yeah.
Well, damn it. I tried.
Sargon, do you want to take a second to kind of wrap up your.
No, you can just listen to what Brittany said again. That was perfect. I completely agree with her.
This is probably like the one of the best talks that we've had on here. I mean, we didn't have to interject one time. Usually it's us trying to fight between the two people that are talking over each other. That's how it's done right there. That was excellent. Okay, Steve.
I told you.
You did.
So, Steve, do you have some questions from the live chat?
We do have some questions from the live chat. Let me just interject one quick thing, if I may first, and see if you guys both agree, as this was kind of contentious in the live chat, and this is my belief as well, that we can argue that there are inherent rights that are natural rights, inherent by being the fact, by virtue, we are human, that without invoking a God, and that human rights inherently, by definition, are something that are not bestowed to us by the government. If the government gives you, quote, inherent rights, they're not rights at that point, they're privileges. Would you guys think that makes sense?
Well, I think that the important thing from liberal theory, at least, is to understand that the government's purpose is to protect your rights. And your rights are inherent to you. And the legitimate. And this is why we don't find non-democracies legitimate governments. This is why people are freaking out that Trump's being pally with Kim Jong-un, because we don't consider dictatorship a legitimate form of government. But, sorry, I'm getting a bit of echo back all for some reason. That's the legitimate function of government in liberal theory. And ultimately, we all tacitly agree with that. So, I mean, like most people do anyway. And that's how liberal democracies continue to function.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Okay. So some of the questions were, I'm going to start with the one, Brittany. And these are kind of two questions I'm going to combine to one, because they're very similar. For Brittany, at what point do we stop applying systematic intersectionality in an effort to keep it from spawning systemic individuality? And then the follow-up would have been, can you see how intersectionality will eventually lead to individualism?
Yeah, I do. I think that any thought process that gets introduced to white society needs to be understood that means that person, whoever created it, saw a need for it, and they created it because of that need. So once the need is met, I don't think philosophies usually need to stay longer than they're needed. So if they're an active thing like intersectionality, intersectionality is just the acknowledgement that this is how the system works. But the, sorry, my alarm, how obnoxious. But the idea is eventually we'll get to a point where we can look back and say, ah, yes, the times when intersectionality was needed. Fun, good times, now over. That's the goal. And I think that takes time and generational gaps. And I think it takes having many, many children who learn to not judge a book by its cover. And it's a lot of like the 90s, what they attempted in the 90s, but couldn't actually make it real or implement. But I do think that people should exist in their really unique and individualistic ways. And intersectionality, acknowledging that theory as a reflection of the time it was created and why it was created, I think is a positive. Does that answer your question?
Maybe I might have it backwards then, because I thought intersectionality was trying to produce more of a collective and try to weigh the pros and cons of who is being more oppressed, who is being least oppressed, based upon certain properties of an individual, race, class, creed, those kinds of things.
Sure. Well, but if you got to an that's how it starts off, and you need to acknowledge. So we need to acknowledge that that's the case. But eventually, if people come to an understanding, at least in the U.S., because I don't really know how to use the metric with other countries, but in the U.S., there will come a time when everyone should be existing in a more harmonious and peaceful state of you do you, boo. Like a legit you do you, boo. As a, you know, I think we can really get there. I just think it's going to be a little bit more complicated, but I do think intersectionality is a great way to start. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty darn great way to start.
Can I address something there? Yeah. That can never happen because intersectionality is pathologically obsessed with inequality. And if people are left alone to do their own thing, then you'll get nothing but inequality. And the whole thrust of intersectionality is to eliminate these inequalities. And they're very, very forthright about that. So the idea that we can ever achieve anything approaching you do you through intersectionality is preposterous to me.
Well, I will say, and I will concede on one point, that I do think there are people who say they're intersectionality feminists, but intersectional, but they'll say things like intersectionality is anti-capitalism, but that's not really true, is it? Like the foundation of Kimberly's thoughts were never that. Everything I've learned from her so far isn't rooted in capitalism being destroyed. It's rooted in capitalism being acknowledged as not the most fair system, which it is not. And it's not to say that
the most fair system. You couldn't imagine a fairer one.
I accept it for what it is. I don't really worry about changing it too much. I can exist within its confines, but I don't think it's like the greatest, most ethical system.
I'm not saying that there aren't unfairnesses within capitalism, but it's just as a system, it's like democracy. It's the worst system, but the better, it's a bad system, but the best of the rules we've discovered so far. And
I agree, if that is your system.
There aren't flaws, but I'm saying it's the best one we have. You know,
sure, I'm okay with that.
The most fair one we have. Yeah, okay. But intersectionality necessarily has to be against capitalism because capitalism produces inequality. There's no choice.
Is not intersectionality predicated on inequality? I mean, isn't that the whole reason why there's an intersectionality movement? Because of
eliminate inequality. Yeah.
I would argue that it's to acknowledge inequality and then as a way of figuring out now how to implement it in a way that would help mitigate, you know, unfairness. But I really do think the core of intersectionality, from my understanding, and she's coming out with a book in 2019, but from her talks, because I don't trust the people who take people and twist their philosophies to match their own ideas. So I'm taking it strictly from Kimberly. It's an acknowledgement of the disparity. And then hopefully by acknowledging it, like AA, you have to admit you have a problem before you start. We can then fulfill steps to make sure that that's not happening so much. But we need to do it by bringing minorities up and everyone up with them, in my opinion.
I don't agree that inequality and unfairness are synonyms. You used them as synonyms just now. It's not unfair that someone's not the same as me, but in the same regard, it's not unfair that I'm not as attractive as you. You know, it's not something that can be countered. It's not something that it doesn't give you a moral license to start taking over society in order to try and erase the inequalities, because you're necessarily going to have to start oppressing people to do that. Because if you want to erase all the inequalities, what you have to do is reduce everyone to the position of zero. You've got to remove anything that anyone's ever worked for. And so, you know, I don't want to have to make you as ugly as me. That would be a terrible thing. But that's the only way we're going to become equal in regards to that, isn't it? So inequality isn't necessarily a bad thing.
My personal philosophy as a Brittany is not that we should strive to live in a world without unfairness, or we should strive to all be the same in terms of our in terms of physical or money value, but instead that we should strive to live in a country that represents those who are saying, hey, I don't think I'm getting the things I want out of life. In what ways can I have those things, like accessibility to jobs or accessibility to, you know, opportunity? Disabled is a great example. Everyone in intersectionality loves disabled people right now, as do people. But sidewalks are a perfect weird example. Like, there are things that everyday non-disabled physical people might not think about, but people with disabilities who have to worry about wheelchairs over curbs are fighting for representation through law. So that's just examples of ways that intersectionality is, I think, positively talking about affecting society. And by doing this, we're not making the person who can't walk all of a sudden, but we're allowing them the same chance to get across that sidewalk in at least somewhat of an easier way. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah. But okay. I mean, in my country, like, you know, through the 80s and 90s, we had legislation put in place where, you know, buildings have to have disabled access and things like this. You know, at the edge of each curb is a slope downwards so that people with wheelchairs can get up it. But it didn't require intersectionality.
Well, I hope we can get to that place, because we're not there yet. There are many places.
I agree that's something you can lobby for as well. But that didn't require intersectionality. You know, it doesn't require a prescriptive, tyrannical movement, social movement to do that. I mean, you can do that operating from a liberal point of view, which I think is a way more productive way of doing things, because you don't alienate people when you're doing that.
I think this is a beautiful moment, everybody, because I must say something that, again, I consider pretty controversial. I do not think you need to be intersectional or feminist. I do not think to move society forward. I don't think your labels matter. Your actions do. But that means that in order to make it clear to other people what you're trying to do and to bring groups together, sometimes labels help coax people in, or sometimes, in this case, I might reject them out. So I think we might agree more on that front. I don't mean, and I'm so sorry if that was the impression when I was asked to come on this show, that I would say you have to do intersectional or you're out, but that is not, that's not my belief.
We just wanted a conversation between you two. It wasn't, you know, we weren't looking for any kind of fireworks. Yeah,
I'm sorry if you thought that I meant that you must have an opinion. Obviously, I don't think you must have any opinions, but there are lots of people who say that they're intersectional feminists or, you know, just intersectional activists who do hold that kind of opinion. And so that seems to be the stock opinion for intersectionality. I mean, like I wouldn't define you as an intersectional feminist. You seem to disagree with a lot of the things they say, but kind of hang on to a couple of their beliefs for some reason. And I think that you're better than that. You know, you seem way better than them. They seem like horrible people. You seem like a lovely person. So
I am a lovely person. That's for sure true. And some people are awful people, but I don't think that when movements get created, I think the origin is always the most pure. So I think intersectionality at its origin was pure. I think what it is now is not what Kimberly had intended. And I do think that I am trying to sit here as a feminist and say, hey, like, feminists, we need to be a little bit more objective truth and more, a little bit more logical when we're implementing these advocacy wants. And that's all I'm personally trying to do as a YouTuber and content creator, is just to say that if we can see other people's, like, if you want people to see your story, you have to see their story. And then we need to come to a compromise. And that's sort of my whole belief system on my channel. That's why I have so many people who are different, Republican and Libertarian and stuff. I have a lot of MAGA people. And I'm all about it. Please come hang out with me. Like, come chill with me. We have these great discussions. Let's do it at MythCon. But this is exactly, by the way, how I thought the conversation would go. I thought it would be super chill. I was surprised, like, we even needed a moderator, but I was like, nah, Carl's going to be chill. I'm going to be chill. It's going to be fine.
You didn't.
None of us are moderators here. We're just hosts.
We're just watching.
Part of the conversation, but we're not just watching this. There's no need to.
You guys were fabulous.
You're doing great.
Steve, was that it?
There's a couple more questions. Yeah, and by the way, Brittany, and somebody was talking about this earlier, and it's probably a good time to bring it up. You're talking about feminism. Isn't the same thing could be applied to second wave feminism, like egalitarianism, how it's now been promoted and changed and moved to this third and fourth wave feminists? And people like myself, I don't identify with the feminist movement because of that. I don't like the radicalization that has happened. However, people will assume that that means you're not egalitarian or you don't accept second wave, which I find to be kind of strange. I don't see the correlation there. How do you address something like that when people say, well, I'm not a feminist because I don't like the way the feminist movement is going now, but of course I'm egalitarian. Do you think that they have to accept that label or not?
No, absolutely. I have so many women friends or man friends or non-binary friends that are not feminist that reject that label, and they are just as valid and important in the fight for of a better life and a freer life, and I promote them in those things. I love feminism because it taught me so much, but I also acknowledge there's like 12 different philosophies of feminism, and as a woman, I even support TERF's right to exist as feminist. I don't think you're less of a feminist if you're trans exclusive. I just think you're a different form of feminist, and I think it's a valid form of feminism as any form of feminism. I just think we have different wants out of existence, and that's why these labels come in handy. It's just to say, hey, are you part of my group or not a part of my group? I personally say feminist as a whole, and I don't specify generational feminist because I understand why every single part of feminism came about. It's very, makes sense. It's very logical. There was a thing that happened. This created it. Cool. That makes total sense to my brain. But as a feminist, you do not like Amy Schumer, who I think is the most deplorable human I've ever seen in media, worse than Trump. And she said, if you're not a feminist, you're against women. And I just looked at her and I was like, I bought that for like 30 seconds. And then I realized it makes no freaking sense. And it doesn't make sense. And it's fine that it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make feminism inherently wrong. It doesn't make anything wrong. It just doesn't make sense as a statement. It is not factually true and is not helpful. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I know we got to be wrapping this up soon. We have one last question for
Sargon. Do you want to follow up on that?
Really short.
I think.
Just very quickly. It actually does make sense if you view everything as a zero sum game, which ultimately is the inevitable result of identity politics. If you're not for something, you're against something. It's basically the Calvinist view of identity that Amy Schumer's preparing there, putting forward there. Because if you're not helping them advance their goals, then their goals aren't being advanced. So you're against them. That's how they view it. So, I mean, I agree with you completely that what she said there is nonsense. You know, I'm not a sort of identitarian Calvinist or anything like that, obviously. But it does have its own internal logic, and she is just following that to the sort of nth degree. But that's where your sort of fundamental axioms of your belief don't lead there. You seem like a liberal feminist to me, you know, like an empowerment choice feminist. Yeah.
I am very much a liberal.
Yeah, and this is one of my problems with intersectionalism, because it's very seductive and it sounds very internally consistent, but it is internally consistent, but what it's going to produce is tyranny. And as a liberal, I'm obviously opposed to tyranny, and so I have to reject intersectionality on its face, especially as individualistic liberalism has the answers that I'm looking for anyway. It will eventually, through our, you know, collective activism, eventually get us to a point where people aren't being oppressed in the ways that we've inherited from our inferior past. But I don't think intersectionality is going to, I mean, it could do that it could solve a set of problems, but it'll create a set of new and, in my opinion, worse problems. So I think that you should consider being less intersectional and be more liberal, because you do seem fundamentally to be liberal. And this is why I think, you know, this is why you can talk to people from other political ideologies, whereas most intersectionalists don't, you know, they can't stand the idea, you know?
I am very disappointed by them for that reason. And I'm sitting here like, I actually Googled, I was like, has Carl ever actually had a chance to talk to a feminist? And he's like, cause I was afraid you were going to, maybe, I don't know, want to like pwn the feminist. And I was like, I just want to have a conversation. But my way of conversing is very, I tried to be efficient and pragmatic. So if intersectional came to me and they like the left, take the craziest on the left people. And they came to me and they were like, if you're not with us, you're against us. I'd be like, okay, bye. because you're literally alienating me as an ally and as a peer who wants similar things. If you're telling me what you want is freedom of the individual, if you tell me what you want is communism or socialism or any of these things, I'm going to have a discussion with you on those things. But if you argue that you just want to be treated fairly, then I will fight for you. But make sure that that's what you're asking me to ally myself against. So the moment any ideology or label I adhere to doesn't do that, I will either lose it or try to reform it, like I've tried to do with feminism, which is to remind people that I don't need you to hold my hand. I just need you to get the fuck out of my way.
See, now that you, now I'm convinced you're a liberal. And so now I'm convinced that in,
I am a liberal.
But the thing is, intersectionalism is fundamentally Marxist. That's the problem I have with it. It's completely at odds with liberalism. And so I think that the more you inquire into the sort of root philosophies underlying these, I think the more you'll find, you the more you look at intersectionalism. I'm sure that Elizabeth Crenshaw that you were reading, was it? Kimberly Crenshaw. I'm sure that she has very seductive rhetoric, and they often do. They really do. But when you actually sort of take the time to lay it all out and really drill into it, I bet in 5 years' time you won't call yourself intersectional. I bet you'll call yourself an empowerment or liberal feminist rather than intersectional one.
And I'm very open to that possibility. 100%. I must always be open to change and new information.
Yep.
Do we want to take another question? I think that was we've gone almost 2 hours. We usually try to cap it off at 90 minutes, but this was well worth the overtime. But I don't think this could have gone any better in any way. I think surprisingly, you two seemingly completely opposite individuals came together on a really a good point, and that doesn't happen often. So. Thank you both for coming on. That was fantastic. One of my favorite talks, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It was great, guys.
I was not disappointed.
Anytime you want. You can always ask. Always ask.
Awesome. I appreciate that. And let me give a huge thanks to KC for being the middle woman. Literally, she is the middle woman here. But KC, thank you so much. We appreciate all of your help. She is like a rock here on the Non Sequitur Show, so we appreciate her. But thank you guys.
I was really glad to facilitate this talk. I knew that they would have a good conversation because I've talked to both of them, and I know that they can be both very reasonable people, and they think about the things that they're saying, I think, for the most part. So, like, I thought it would be a great conversation. I'm glad it went well, and I was not surprised at all.
Yeah, I followed Sargon for a couple years now, watching him, and I always thought he was reasonable. Brittany, this is my first. Preparing for this episode was my first interaction with you, and I checked out your videos. But I like you both. I think you both have different ideas, and it's okay to be able to check boxes in different categories and not box yourself into one seemingly solid ideology. So it was really cool to have both of you on here. Very cool. And to thank everyone you out there, tomorrow, Tim O'Neill at 8:00, and then Debate Roulette on Saturday. So thank you guys once again. Thank you, Steve. Thank you both, Dave, for doing sound. And we will see all of you guys tomorrow.